From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. In the first half of today's show, we'll speak with Zoe Schlanger about her new book, The Light Eaters, how the unseen world of plant intelligence offers a new understanding of life on Earth.
Yes, it takes tremendous biological creativity to be a plant, to survive and thrive while rooted in a single spot. As a result, plants have adapted ingenious methods of survival, and in recent years, scientists have learned about their ability to communicate, recognize their kin, and behave socially, hear sounds, morph their bodies to blend into their surroundings, store useful memories that inform their life cycle, and trick animals into behaving to their benefit. And that's just to name a few remarkable talents. Zoe Schlanger and her new book, The Light Eaters, in the first part of the show.
Then in the second half of the show, we're going to be speaking with biologist Nara DeGracia about her new book, The Last Cold Place, a field season studying penguins in Antarctica.
That's right. The memoir offers a window into a once-in-a-lifetime experience, a season living and working in a remote outpost in Antarctica alongside seals, penguins, and a small crew of fellow field workers. In one of the most inhospitable environments in the world, the Grazia follows a generation of chinstrap penguins from their parents' return to shore to build nests from pebbles until the chicks themselves are old enough to head out to sea. Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
We are really excited today to welcome Zoe Schlanger, who is going to be telling us about a new book that has been penned.
By her.
It's called The Light Eaters. Yes, of course. So tell us, Zoe, welcome first to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
First, I want to know a little bit about your background, about your writing. You primarily have been writing about climate challenges and the environment, and then how you came about writing this particular new book, The Light Eaters.
Yeah. So like you said, I cover climate change. I'm on staff at The Atlantic magazine, and I have been covering climate change for something like 10 years. And climate change coverage is pretty rough. It's a pretty depressing field to be working in. And a few years ago, I just felt like I had had enough. I was getting a little bit numb to, you know, things like wildfires and melting ice sheets, which are massive devastations. But when you read about them too much, it's hard to stay connected with the facts. So I started diverting my attention to plants, and I've always found them incredibly soothing. And there's lots of research now to tell us that spending time in nature and green places is actually very good for our psychology. So I thought I'd tap into that. What I didn't expect was to find that there was this huge debate roiling inside botany circles at that time about whether or not plants might be intelligent. Some scientists were going so far as to say we should consider them conscious. And the reason they were even considering these things at all is because new technology was making it possible to ask questions of plants we never had before. We could actually watch their communication in real time. We could sample the gases they were emitting to see what they were doing in this private, invisible world. And scientists were realizing plants are incredibly dynamic. They're able to summon beneficial predators. They're able to recognize who they're planted beside and adjust their behavior accordingly, share resources. I mean, the facts coming out were remarkable, and I knew I had to pursue this as a story.
Yeah, and you mentioned communication, and I thought that that was in particular something really interesting that you delved into. Tell us more about how plants can communicate with each other.
Sure. So plants have these pores all over their leaves, and under a microscope, they look like little fish slips opening and closing. It's actually very funny. And plants have this incredible capacity to synthesize chemical compounds in their bodies. And for plants, that is their language. The compounds and the order of the compounds and the ratios, that's their syntax. Those are their sentences. And they emit those through these pores on their leaves. And the gases float on the air, and other plants take them back up through their pores. And through that exchange, there's information being passed. So let's say there's caterpillars attacking a plant. That plant will release chemicals that are an alarm call, kind of like how you can hear birds screeching when they notice a predator. And it's an alarm call that can be received by plants of the same species, of other species. And then those plants who are receiving that call will boost their own immune systems. They'll make their leaves bitter. They'll make them less nutritious. We know things like tomato plants are able to boost their defenses in such a way that causes caterpillars to turn toward cannibalism. Corn are able to summon predatory wasps to come eat caterpillars off of them. And so if they have advanced notice of this, they can enact all those incredible defenses early and try to save themselves.
Right. I think there's some similar evidence that suggests that some types of spruce and pine out here react in the same way with respect to bark beetle infestation, that a tree that gets attacked by a bark beetle has a capacity to emit a chemical, have a chemical-based response to warn other trees of a presence of a pest, and thereby excrete or produce sap or so to protect the tree. So other examples like that too.
Yeah, incredible. It is amazing, these adaptations, and it makes evolutionary sense. If you're a plant or a tree that has been rooted in place and evolved that way, you have to be able to handle anything that's coming at you because you can't run away. So I'm not surprised to hear that. It's amazing the things we're finding across
right.
species.
So there are some, I guess the argument or the push and pull here is that some scientists may think that this is a form of quote unquote intelligence, while others think may perhaps believe that this is just a form of a kind of a reactionary process. Where is the push and pull between scientists with this idea of intelligence and even consciousness?
Well, when you think about the idea of intelligence or consciousness, these are very squishy terms.
Right.
There is no scientific definition for either one. We actually still haven't figured out the mechanical basis for our own consciousness. So these are open questions in science, and scientists themselves are pretty conservative in their use of language. They don't want to use words that they can't precisely define. So the fight is centered on the fact that, you know, do we really have to put these human concepts on plants, which are incredible, dynamic, but entirely alien to us in a way? I mean, they evolved very separately from us and have completely different systems. And the other big debate is there's no brain. We can't find a brain in plants. And we have not historically ascribed intelligence or consciousness to organisms that do not have brains. So some researchers feel that that's ill-informed to try to do that. But others are saying, well, what if it's not sensible to look for a brain in a plant? They evolve differently. They are modular. They have this sort of diffuse ability to sense. Maybe we need to expand the notion of a mind to include things that are incredibly receptive and make decisions and have dynamic behaviors, but don't necessarily have brains.
Do you see us trying to maybe then humanize the plant world?
Too much?
Yeah, I wonder, because I do believe in this connection in the natural world, and you talk about how different plant species interact with each other and maybe are even protecting each other in these environments. But do we try to make those plants also have that agency and feeling, or are you seeing that in the research?
It's an interesting thing, right? I think as humans, we are prone to sort of make everything into a metaphor that relates back to ourselves. And scientists caution against that. And I would too. I mean, as I said, plants are utterly alien to us. And yet there is plenty of evidence that points to the fact that biology is biology kind of across taxa of life. There are parallel structures that have arisen again and again throughout life forms. I mean, one example is flight that evolved separately in birds and bats and insects, all to very similar effect. Or eyeballs, that's another one, evolved separately many times. So we do look at a plant and we're seeing now, we're understanding now that there's electrical impulses that move through them. There's signaling that works in a way that some researchers have deemed is quite similar to nervous conduction. That there's some argument to say maybe we should expand these otherwise restrictive terms, like how we define our nervous system, to include what it is a plant has. If they are signaling across long distances in their body, potentially using electrical impulses to do that, maybe it's just a plant nervous system, different from a human nervous system, but still that form just the same, in the same way we would call flight flight across many different forms of life as well.
We're speaking with Zoe Schlanger. She's an environmental journalist and the author of the new book, The Light Eaters: How the Unseen World of Plant Intelligence Offers a New Understanding of Life on Earth. And getting back to the kind of the social aspect of plants, you know, we can think first that perhaps a species of aspen will communicate with each other or so in chemical form or otherwise. But are plants communicating with other species of plants? Is there a social network there?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it would seem absurd if a human was able to directly communicate with a rhinoceros, but we're seeing essentially different plant species doing exactly that, crossing that species divide, able to speak, so to speak, through chemicals to each other across that species divide, and not just with other plants. I mean, plants are communicating with insects all the time, with animals, in sort of in summoning them to do their bidding in certain cases, or proposing collaborations in other cases. There's a whole class of plants called ant plants, for example, that produce sugary sap specifically to feed plants, and they create little niches in their bodies to house ants. And they have this relationship with ants. It's kind of, they strike this deal where the ants will defend the plants from all other pests. They will literally dismember anything else that tries to come attack the plant in exchange for room and board, essentially.
In the introduction, we talked about, among other things that we've already discussed, you know, their social behavior, their ability to communicate. One here says they also store useful memories that inform their life cycle. Can you talk a little bit about how that, or even how scientists have teased that information out of plants?
Right. So there's obviously no brain to look at here.
Right.
The mechanical substrates of this are pretty much still a mystery, but we do know certain plants can count and store counting information that's useful to them later. There's a flower in the high mountains in Peru, in the Andes, that can assess the number of pollinators in the area by counting the time interval between pollinator visits. So let's say they're being pollinated by a bee or a fly. That flower will record the amount of time between two visits of those insects and parcel out their pollen to make sense for the number of pollinators in the area. And, you know, if you're a flower growing in a very spare high altitude environment, it makes sense. You want every single pollination moment to count. So this plant will literally lift its stamen when it expects a pollinator to arrive based on the changing time intervals before it. Or Venus flytrap is a very flashy plant. We can actually watch it move in real time. Mm-hmm. Humans love that. And the way that they catch an animal that's fallen into their trap or been drawn into their trap is by counting the number of little trigger hairs inside their maw that have been flicked. And so it's not enough for one trigger hair to be flicked. You know, they won't close on a pebble or something that's not moving. They wait for several of these to be flicked within a certain number of seconds to decide to actually close. And it has to continue moving in there and flicking more of these hairs for digestion to begin. And if it doesn't keep moving, the trap will reset and it won't bother digesting. So we know that there's addition there, there's subtraction in a way, and counting of time.
Do we have any sense of that? Perhaps there are some species of plants that, dare I say it, are more, say, intelligent than other species? Or is there a universe of intelligence out there?
It's a really great question. It sort of depends how you want to define intelligence.
Right.
If we're just talking about plants making good decisions for the future by using all of the inputs in the environment and various variables to make that choice, most plants do that, it seems. But we do get to see more complex phenomena that relates to what we might call intelligence in higher plants, so to speak, flowering plants, like this Andean flower that can remember, or the Venus flytrap that can count. Depends where you want to actually stick a pin in it and call it intelligence. Mm-hmm. In some ways, anything that's managing to survive in variable extremes is doing something very clever.
Yeah, and I also think about this relationship between plants and animals and in humans. We pick up seeds, we pick up different pollens, and we transport. We do a lot of transporting, so you see maybe a plant being put into a new environment or blossoming maybe where it wouldn't before. Are you finding that in this world of intelligence that maybe if this plant is introduced that you're seeing these adaptations and defenses, and then it also informs its ecosystem in a different way?
Absolutely, yes. So for part of this book, I did a lot of research and talking to invasion biologists, people who study invasive species. Mm. And that's a bit of what you're talking about, right? We move these species around the world, and they sometimes take root and do very well in environments that they weren't evolved to live in, sometimes taking over environments that our native plants would normally be using. And that can be a real problem for us and for the ecosystem. But from the plant's perspective, that invasive species is just doing a fabulous job of being a plant wherever we happen to put it. There's research now into plant epigenetics, which is a field we research in humans, the idea that the environment that your parent or your grandparent experienced, let's say your grandparent or your parent experienced heavy air pollution. We know now that you, as their offspring, are more likely to develop asthma or to have breathing issues because of that, the parental environment. Plants also have this sort of epigenetic memory, so to speak. So invasive species are particularly good at this, passing down adaptations to their offspring to make them better suited and more successful in the environment that they find themselves in. So a plant that's, let's say, grown in low light conditions or low water conditions, often with invasive species, we see that their offspring are better able to handle them right out of the gate. They have physiological changes in their body that help them better survive in those conditions. So really, when you see a plant doing very well, taking over, you're seeing epigenetic ancestral adaptation happening in real time and to incredible effect. They're just very resourceful and very good at passing down that resourcefulness.
Are plants who are able to adapt to human stressors, most notably, say, herbicides and other chemical applications, is that an example of a plant's ability to process the stressor and adapt to it or change its behavior in some way?
There's this interesting thing with crop plants. And when I talk to farmers about this, they seem to immediately understand or like know that what I'm talking about because they've seen it themselves. But you see a lot of weeds in crop fields that mimic whatever the crop is that they're growing with. Like, for example, there's a kind of vetch that will mimic lentils, or it turns out rye, for example, was an inedible plant that was a weed in wheat fields hundreds of years ago, quite a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And that rye, because of the selective pressure of being constantly weeded out, started morphing its body to be more like the wheat. And that is how we got the edible rye plant we have today. So there's some thinking that this type of mimicry, it's called Vavilovian mimicry after the person who discovered this, is actually maybe what's going on when weed plants become resistant to herbicides that we use to try to kill them. Perhaps this is Vavilovian mimicry at the genetic level, in that these weed plants are attempting to mimic the crop plant, which is resistant, designed to be resistant to the herbicide we're using. So this is a brand new concept, but if plants can shape their bodies to be more palatable to us and to not get weeded out, perhaps they can also reshape their underlying physiology that makes them resistant to pesticides.
Right. All right. So a few more minutes. I have to go there. What are the observations of plants' adaptability with respect to a warming world? In some cases, a drying world or a wetter world, i.e. climate change.
Yeah, so this is where the rubber meets the road for how much a plant can adapt. We're talking about these amazing adaptations, the amazing things they can do to survive. But everything has its limits, right? Mm. So when the climate changes very quickly or faster than a plant can adapt to, they're not going to make it. And this is when we start to see early extinction or distribution of that plant moving. You know, I'm in the Northeast. I know that in Acadia National Park in Maine, they're losing their tree species because of how warm it's getting. Those trees are migrating northward. Hmm. So there is migration. You don't think about trees, you know, walking away, but right. they are seeding themselves and only able to survive now in farther northern latitudes. And that changes our landscapes. It changes the landscapes we hoped to keep forever. And in some cases, we lose those species. And I think that that's the biggest thing doing this research has taught me. It's every single species of plant is this product of incredible biological creativity, incredible evolutionary resourcefulness, and fascinating dynamics. And snuffing out any one of these is a real shame. There's kind of no excuse for that anymore when you start to understand how remarkable each one of these plants actually are. And climate change, if it's continued to be, if it's allowed to continue, mm-hmm. will rob us of more and more of these incredible specimens of life.
And with that, it robs other, you know, the species that rely on that. There is obviously a ripple effect. You know,
exactly. So yes. The there's insects, a cascade and, of everything.
Yeah, exactly. So everything is at risk like that.
Right. I'm going to lighten it up just a little bit.
No.
No.
It's important.
No, I think it's very important. And obviously, this is a topic that's very near and dear to our hearts. And we talked about sure. how climate change gets heavy. It's something that obviously we speak to weekly on this program. And we are in this ever-changing global warming world. But what I wanted to talk about a little bit is a house plant that is my favorite. And I speak a little bit more tenderly to it or love on it, maybe just a little bit more. So I don't know if it's beautiful and green because of that. There was a study that was done where they had kids talking to plants and they had kids that kind of ignored a plant. Mm. And then they had kids speaking lovingly to a plant. Is that true? Do you see that if we are kinder and gentler and speak lovely to a plant that it will be more prosperous
respond
than another?
To that?
Yeah.
First of all, I haven't seen that study, but that sounds absolutely adorable. I would have loved to be a scientist working on that project. As far as I understand, there's no reason that talking to your plant in a specific way would make it grow better, but there is plenty of reason why, if you're already paying that kind of attention to the plant, maybe you are adjusting your own behavior in ways that actually benefit the plant. Maybe you're more in tune with when it really needs water, or you're really noticing when it needs more nutrients in its soil. All of that is possible. Plants do respond to sounds that are ecologically important to it. Like, we know plants can react to the sound of a caterpillar chewing, or the sound of running water. These are things they evolved alongside and are useful to their survival. I'm not sure about the talking, but there's no reason anyone should stop talking to their plants. If it makes you feel more in touch with them, you're probably a better plant parent for it.
That was just a curiosity that I had.
No.
Having seen that, and it might have been just something for, you know, a lighter way to look at the world of plants.
Well, let's be clear.
Definitely.
Plants have been around for millions and millions of years, way before us, and they're going to be here way after we depart. So
also true.
They're like you say, so there's a form of intelligence that's maybe not akin to ours. You know, they're not going to evolve to the point where they're going to be sitting around cafe tables discussing Flaubert and the French
writing poetry.
Right, and the French New Wave. But they have a form of intelligence and possibly a parallel type of consciousness that has allowed them to survive, that has all this time, and has created a form of adaptation. But like you say, so with climate change, it's the rate of adaptation.
Right.
That is really putting the stress on plants and animals, et cetera.
Well,
and
Zoe,
that's the biggest challenge.
Yeah, where can people go to learn more about you, your writings, and get their hands on this book?
Absolutely. Well, the book is available starting today. Everywhere books are sold, The Light Eaters, and in 8 languages. So if you're in other countries, you can get it there too. I have a website, zoeschlanger.com. And I'd love to be in touch with any of your listeners.
Well, we truly appreciate you taking the time on this very busy day, I'm sure, the release of your book. The name of the book, again, is The Light Eaters, How the Unseen World of Plant Intelligence Offers a New Understanding of Life on Earth. Zoe Schlanger, environmental journalist, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
It's been great talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And joining us in the second part of the show is Naira DeGrazia. She's a biologist and the author of the new book, The Last Cold Place, a field season studying penguins in Antarctica. Naira, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about you first. Give us a little background on yourself. Why did you decide to become a biologist, and what led you to Antarctica?
Yeah, so I guess I can start by mentioning that I grew up moving around a lot. My parents are journalists, and we moved to a new country every few years. So I had a little bit of an uprooted childhood, but I always found myself to be most grounded when I was like hanging out in a forest or up in mountains or in trees. And when I went to university, I was really drawn to biology and the understanding of ecosystems as like this bigger bio system that was beyond like human constructs. And I worked at as a field season in Maine as a technician on a seabird nesting island. And I just really was compelled by the lifestyle of field work first, I think, and then my love for like the discipline followed. And I really enjoyed living in these remote places and being able to see ecosystems that few people get to see. And I think I've always been driven towards the more intense or the most intense version of any experience. So in that sense, I really wanted to work in Antarctica because of the isolation of the experience and also how amazing the ecosystem down there is and how immersive the field camp down there was. So yeah, I did a few field jobs after university, and eventually I got the Antarctica job, which was my goal. So I headed down there.
What is a field season?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm so used to using these terms, eh?
Yeah.
So basically any study that has a long-term monitoring aspect that looks at an ecosystem over many years. When you see studies that show declines in population or declines in reproductive capacity, that's usually because they have these monitoring camps in place that follow seabird or seal populations over many, many years with the same methodology. So these studies tend to have technicians like me that go out there for the season, which is basically the breeding season of that species or target plural species that the study is looking at. And we basically are out there counting populations, and then we track nests or seal pairs to see how many of the young that are produced actually make it to young adulthood, and see how successful the species is that season. So a field season is basically that reproductive period in which technicians are stationed in the field or in the study area to monitor a population.
And so the species that you're focused on were chinstrap penguins. So give us a little thumbnail sketch of what a chinstrap penguin is.
Yeah, so we were looking at two species actually, were chinstraps and gentoos. So they're both, they live in the Southern Ocean, which is basically the circumpolar ocean around Antarctica. They feed, chinstraps mostly feed on krill during the winter and in the summer breeding season as well. And gentoos feed more on fish than krill, but also eat a lot of krill. And basically these penguins are out in the ocean all winter, and they only come to land. They come to land in the summer to breed, and they usually breed on these small islands like off the coast of Antarctica. So that's when we coincide with them and we can study their behavior. But they're being impacted by climate change in a pretty severe way, because krill depends on ice in the early stages of their development. And as temperatures warm, the ice around Antarctica, the sea ice cover is decreasing year after year. And so that means there's less habitat for young krill and there's less krill out in the ocean. So the food source is declining. So we are seeing declines in chinstrap and gentoo penguins. And that was a big focus of the monitoring program that I worked on.
So in these comparisons of where life has been in the past, there, where it is now, and what the projections are for the future, what are you seeing now that is in decline from how it had maybe been thriving in the past?
Yeah, so it's interesting to see how different species respond to these environmental changes. Like, for example, I mentioned that chinstraps are more dependent on krill, so they are showing a bigger decline in population, but gentoos have a bit more of a flexible diet. Mm. So they can also eat fish or like other small, you know, swimming creatures in the ocean, and they're able to adapt a little easier. And chinstraps as well have a bit of more of an abrupt leap into adulthood. They literally just stop getting fed by the adults and just have to swim into the ocean and learn to feed and survive. Whereas gentoos have a bit of a buffer period where the young kind of swim around a bit and learn to hunt while also still being fed by the adults. So these changes in these differences in their life history is really affecting how they're responding to climate change. And then on the other side, in the marine mammal side, we're seeing like really big declines in fur seals, Antarctic fur seals, which was the other species that was studied in the camp that I worked at. So they are also krill dependent. And that has more to do with habitat shifting for leopard seals. So leopard seals used to hang out on ice, but because there's a lot less ice, they've started hanging out more on the shore of these islands where Antarctic seals breed, Antarctic fur seals breed. And so they end up eating a lot more Antarctic fur seal pups because they're forced to live more on land. And so that's also driving the decline in Antarctic fur seals. So it's all these like very specific dynamics that each species has that, yeah, impacts how sensitive they are to changes in the environment.
Wow. Okay. Again, the ripple effects associated with a warming world, in this case, warming seas and such. But I want to go back. I want to go back to the chinstraps and try to understand. You say the adults, I'm going to say, are out at sea all winter. A, mm-hmm. How long is this winter? And B, what does it mean literally to be out at sea for months and months at a time?
Yeah, they sound like medieval sailors when I put it that way.
Yeah.
Out at sea. So they're pelagic seabirds. So basically what that means, like a lot of other seabirds, is that they don't need land to live. Mm. They use land to reproduce and to have nests. But like in the first 2 or 3 years of their life, for example, before they're of breeding age, they just live in the ocean. So they're able to feed in the ocean. They sleep on the surface of the ocean. Mm. They rest on the surface of the ocean. They just sit on the surface, kind of like a duck, like you would imagine how a duck would sit. And that's just their habitat. That's the habitat they evolved on. And it becomes like pretty obvious when you do encounter them on land, because they're pretty clumsy and awkward on land. You know, they're always like wobbling around and falling down, and like they have these short little stubby legs. But yeah, in the sea, that's their primary habitat. They're just like amazing, amazing swimmers and super strong. They just take off like little torpedoes. So yeah, that's sort of what I mean when their primary habitat is in the ocean. But it's really difficult to study penguins or seabirds in general when they're not in the breeding season, when they're out in the ocean, just because they're so spread out and inaccessible to us. So
right.
that breeding season window is like 3 months where we can really access that species. Yeah.
That was what I was going to ask. What does a day look like? How do you research them? How do you get into their habitat, and how do they respond to you?
Hmm. Yeah. So, the colony that we were studying was about an hour walk from main camp. So we had a little hut out at the penguin colonies, and we'd hike out there in the morning, and we'd basically do what we call rounds, which is we check our colonies. So a colony is just like a grouping of nests, basically, on little hills where the snow melts earlier. So they're able to build their nests there out of little pebbles. And we check certain nests that we're following to see if there are any updates to like have the chicks hatched or have the chicks fledged, depending on what time in the season it is. And then also depending on what time in the season is, we have other things that we do in the colonies, like we'll do banding early season, or sometimes we'll attach devices that that track their dives when they go out to forage, or we look for penguins in the area that are banded from previous years. So we do a lot of resighting. Then we do like certain waves of population counts and weighing chicks. So just a whole bunch of different metrics that indicate different things about how the population is doing. And then, yeah, we basically spend all day out there in the colonies. And the penguins they're not like overly scared of us, because they didn't really evolve with terrestrial predators. Like there aren't really terrestrial, well, there aren't any terrestrial predators in Antarctica. So they just kind of treat you like a really big penguin, which is great. Mm. And it makes it, I mean, we catch them by basically just walking up to their nests and picking them up. So it makes that part of it easier.
So this is just a few months of non-winter conditions, I guess. And this is when the chicks are raised during this period of time. I'm just trying to figure out, are the chicks ever left alone while the adults are out at sea?
Yeah, that's a great question. So they're basically two parents per nest. And once the female lays the two eggs, she goes off to sea to replenish her energy, and the male will sit on the eggs. And then after that, they take turns incubating. And once the chicks hatch, there'll always be an adult at the nest while the other adult is out foraging until the chicks creche, what we call creche, which is basically when they're old enough to be safe from skuas, who are these like predatory seabirds that kind of are in the area, can pick off little chicks that are abandoned by their parents. And also big enough to be able to thermoregulate on their own to be warm. So they're about like 2 or 3 kilos at that point. And then they are left alone by their parents. And they just huddle together in this like giant fluffy pile in the colonies. And then their parents will still come back to feed them regularly, but they'll be out at sea more. And they'll just recognize their chick, and their chick will come up to them, and they'll feed them that way. Yeah, so there are different like life stages to the chick rearing process.
I'm always amazed, you know, at their ability to adults to go out on business for months at a time and then come home and find their home and find their chick, because these are colonies, which, you know, the classic image of penguin colonies, they are stuffed. It's a very dense setting. Is that the same? Is that what a chinstrap penguin's colonies look like?
Yeah, definitely. It's pretty high density, and it is really funny. I mean, I think it's hard not to project like what we imagine they would feel onto the penguins. But I like when they are down at the shore, about to head into the ocean, they just look so dirty. They're full of poop. They're just like exhausted, like hungry, and they spend their whole life in the ocean where there's so much space, and just, you know, they're not crowded together most of the time. So I think it is like a really different experience for a penguin to be jam-packed in those colonies. And then when they come back, they're always like dawdling and procrastinating, going back to their nest. That's what it seems like. I don't know. Probably anthropomorphizing, but.
I think probably parents out there can relate.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, oh, it's my turn again, damn it.
Yeah. Let me reintroduce you as being with Nida de Grazia, the biologist and the author of the book, The Last Cold Place, A Field Season Studying Penguins in Antarctica. So you mentioned briefly some of the changes or challenges that penguins and the entire ecosystem is undergoing in Antarctica with respect to climate change. First, let's talk about what is changing. We know that the oceans are getting warmer. This is probably not your field of expertise, but is it also impacting the seasons themselves? Are the winters getting warmer? Are storms expressing themselves differently? Can you give us a little overview on what climate change looks like in three dimensions? Yes.
So obviously Antarctica is a huge continent, and this slight increase in temperature is manifesting differently across the continent. But the trends that we're seeing most clearly is that it's becoming warmer. The difference is bigger in the winter than it is in the summer. Mm-hmm. And what that means essentially, as I mentioned earlier, is there's a reduction in the sea ice crust. So every winter basically like crust forms from the coast out. A certain amount of kilometers, depending on what part of Antarctica. And then that crust has a lot of glacial melt that comes from the continent. And that glacial melt is really rich in nutrients. And so that forms a crust on the surface because it's not as heavy as seawater, so it stays on the surface. And in the spring, when it melts, all the krill that had been hiding under the ice have access to this like massive abundance of nutrients from the sea ice melt. And so that's, you know, just one of the examples in which the ecosystem of Antarctica is really attuned to this annual cycle of ice formation and ice melt. So what happens when there's less ice is not only, you know, the ocean has a much a different albedo, so it actually absorbs more heat from the atmosphere mm-hmm. and accelerates the warming. But if there's less ice, then the wind will also mix the layers of the ocean, so that really nutrient dense fresh water layer that usually is on the top is mixed in deeper layers where like algae can't access it. So it kind of messes, it makes these nutrients inaccessible basically to the algae and then subsequently krill. And you know, I mentioned the leopard seal issue with like their habitat usually being ice. And then you also have another species, Adelies, who also tend to hang out on ice. So the ice is actually like, you know, we think of it as this like lifeless, just element, but it's really crucial to the ecosystem. And all the species in the Southern Ocean have adapted to the cycle of ice. So when we see a lot less ice, that actually has a really, you know, yeah, as you said, cascading impact on a lot of these species. And we're also seeing, besides from impacts on the ice, the warmth is making weather a lot more volatile. Mm-hmm. And so these species that have been attuned, for example, penguins, to read certain signals in the seasons to think, okay, like this temperature or this, you know, level of sea ice means that it's this time of the year, so it's time to come back to shore to breed, because those signals are changing. Like, for example, there might be a week that's really warm and then you'll get a huge dump of snow. And why that matters is, like, penguins might think it's time to breed, they'll come on shore, they lay their eggs, and then suddenly there's a massive amount of snow. Mm-hmm. That doesn't usually happen that time of year, and they're unable to keep their eggs warm, and then the eggs will die, and they'll be a breeding failure that year. So this increase in unpredictability of the weather kind of messes with these species' ability to like coordinate their breeding season and know like what they need to do when. So that's another pretty major impact in the area.
So as you're studying, I'm imagining in pictures and in data, how far back did the study start that you're looking back and kind of tracking on this? And how do you think this is going to inform our future?
Yeah, so there have been people going to Antarctica since, you know, the early 1900s. The program I worked on specifically has, I think, about 30 years of data to go back on. And these long-term data sets are really important because in Antarctica, there is a lot of year-to-year variation. Like, every year does look different. So you can't really look at a few years. You really have to look at a really long data set to get the bigger trends mm-hmm. Beyond that year-to-year variation. So into the future, it's really important for the program to be able to access the Antarctica and be able to keep collecting that data consistently in the way it has been collected for us to continue to be able to track these changes. And, you know, that's been a huge challenge, as you can imagine, in COVID times. It was a logistical nightmare to try to get down there with, you know, different quarantine requirements, and especially in the early years, like 2020, 2021. But there has been like an increase in use of like technology, like particularly like wildlife cameras that can also capture like maybe the essential dates of a season if they're trained to look at a colony. So the science is changing a little bit in methods, but the goal is to capture basically the same kind of data year to year into the future. So hopefully, you know, this program will be supported forever, basically, is my goal.
Okay. Well, with all these changes going on, like you say, there's physical changes, chemical, biological changes, climate changes. Are there any species that are actually perhaps benefiting from these things? Perhaps are the leopard seals benefiting this from all these changes?
Yeah, that's a great question. I, you know, leopard seals are pretty tricky to study because they're usually pretty they don't really hang out in colonies. So I don't know that we have an accurate view of whether they're benefiting. But I would say that right now we're seeing a slight increase in the population of Gentoo penguins. And that could be a number of factors. One hypothesis is that you know, because they have a much more flexible diet. They're able to survive a slight decrease in krill, and they also have access to more habitat now that it's getting warmer. They're a little warmer weather species, just a number of factors that make them quote unquote climate winner. But I think the important caveat there is that even though there might be slight increases in population in certain species as climate change starts sort of meddling with an ecosystem, at some point, because it's like no species exists on its own, mm-hmm. like in isolation, basically. So if we do get to a point where the warming causes some kind of ecosystem collapse, which would occur if krill don't reach like a certain threshold in their reproduction, then the whole system collapses anyway. So these increases might seem good at like maybe at this point, but they're still completely tied to the fate of the ecosystem as a whole. And it doesn't mean that they would win in the long term.
Right. I would have to put, I had to put air quotes around the word benefit, because it could be just, like you say, a very short term type of thing. Last minute or two. How about you? How did you do in such an uninhabitable or, you know, very difficult conditions? How did you do in that?
Yeah. Honestly, I loved it. It was also hard. I'm not going to lie. Like, it's pretty isolated conditions, and we don't really have access to like basic hygiene either. Like, we showered once every 2 weeks. Mm. You know, you wear socks for like 3 or 4 days before you dispatch them. Like, I didn't do laundry the entire, you're just gross. That's just gross.
Not like a teenage boy locker room, I suspect.
Yeah. But like, all our senses are kind of deadened by like the months of grime, so you don't even notice it. But yeah, I think the things I struggled with were like basic hygiene and also like privacy. We're just like all in one cabin for, you know, the entire time. And
so you need to bring, so perhaps a therapist or a psychologist needs to come along with you guys, if only to evaluate you, you know, do their own separate research on humans and try to address issues that come up. That's its own form of challenge.
Will you be returning, do you think?
Not at this point. I'm actually in grad school in Sweden right now, so I'm not part of the program anymore. But I would love to someday in some capacity. But I think, my life is past the field season point right now. So we'll see. Yeah.
All right.
We are greatly appreciative of you coming on and talking about your findings. You have just written a book. This is Nara DeGracia, who is a biologist. And the book is called The Last Cold Place, A Field Season Studying Penguins in Antarctica. It's befitting for today because we do have actually snow coming down here.
Our own brief, last cold space right now. Yeah.
So thank you so much. We appreciate you being here. And where can people go to find out more about your studies and this book?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. My book is available anywhere you buy books, Amazon or bookshop.org if you want to support your local bookshops. I have a website. I'm on Instagram, not super active on Twitter, but I have a handle on there too. So just, Google my name and you'll find me through there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thanks, Nara.
Thank you.